Iran says it is using every legal channel to bring to justice all those involved in the assassination of the country's top anti-terror commander, General Soleimani. Israeli forces killed two Palestinian youths and injured several others in a raid on a village near the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Also in the headlines, South Korea's president says his country and the U.S. are discussing joint military exercises using nuclear assets. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has described the revival of the resistance front as a major achievement of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was speaking ahead of the anniversary of General Soleimani's assassination by the U.S. Iran's leader said the late general protected, equipped, and prepared the resistance against the Israeli regime and against the influence of the U.S. and other arrogant countries. He cited the defeat of Daesh terrorists as another major achievement of General Soleimani. Ayatollah Khamenei said General Soleimani propped up the resistance in Iraq and Syria using their domestic potential. Meanwhile, Iran says it explores all legal paths in bringing to justice the perpetrators behind the assassination of top military commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Western countries, the U.S. in particular, are seeking to obstruct the legal pursuit of the case. He, however, said Tehran has already filed the complaint and will follow it up in its usual path. The top diplomat noted that some 60 American officials in connection with the assassination have been blacklisted by the Islamic Republic. He added Tehran will pursue the case until they are brought to justice. And Afghan people have gathered at Iran's cultural center in Kabul to pay tribute to veteran anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and commemorate his legacy. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from the Afghan capital.
Afghan people from different walks of life have gathered here at Iran's cultural center to mark the third assassination anniversary of anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani. Participants expressed sympathy with the Iranian nation, saying that General Soleimani was a hero for the entire region.
The pain and grief of the loss of the great martyr Soleimani does not only belong to Iranians. Sardar Soleimani is the hero and flag bearer of the fight against terrorism in the region. He played a very significant and decisive role in our world.
It's the duty of the Muslim world to call for justice for General Soleimani. This huge crime, the killing of a Muslim Iranian general by the U.S., should be investigated by the U.N. Commander Soleimani was targeted by the U.S. when he was busy fighting international terrorism and U.N.-designated terrorist groups.
Participants also say that Commander Soleimani played a key role in the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group in West Asia and in the fight against international criminals.
Commander Soleimani, as a commander of Islam, was there for Muslims everywhere. He was active and supported oppressed people in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Likewise, he was involved in a fight against the arrogance in Afghanistan, too. He trained and directed Afghans to defend their soil against invaders and maintain their freedom. Commander Soleimani fought in a campaign for the freedom of Muslim Ummah.
Commander Qasem Soleimani was unique in thoughts and action. This distinction highlighted his role in the fight against terrorism. He had extraordinary achievements and effects in this way. We can say no one was able to do what he accomplished in the fight against international criminals and terrorists like Daesh. Qasem Soleimani was always present in the battlefield and later became a role model for other freedom seekers and anti-terrorism fighters.
Along with other admirers of General Soleimani, Afghans every year commemorate the legacy and life of the anti-terrorism hero. Afghan people have long been fighting for their freedom. They remember General Soleimani as a leader and a role model for them and for all freedom seekers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turning elsewhere now, Palestinians mourn the loss of two young men killed by Israeli forces during a raid near Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Mohammed Samer, 21, and Fuad Mahmoud, 17, were shot dead during the incursion into the village of Kafr Dan, west of Jenin. Several other people have also been injured. Regime forces raided the area to destroy the homes of two Palestinians involved in an attack on a checkpoint last year. That incident resulted in the death of an Israeli officer. The regime's military conducts almost daily raids across the West Bank. The violence killed at least 150 Palestinians last year. Our correspondent in the occupied territories, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us. She explained why Palestinian youth have joined the fight against the Israeli regime and are willing to sacrifice their lives.
The majority of the Palestinian martyrs who were killed by the Israeli forces and were identified as members of the resistance groups and mainly the newly formed resistance groups, including the so-called group Lion's Den, are very young, 17, 19, 20, 25, the maximum, let's say. This proves, according to experts, that Palestinian youths, those youths who were born in the following the let's say the last intifada or during the last intifada, have seen nothing. They have seen incursions, raids, killings, Israeli atrocities, wars, hearing about the wars that has been killed, that has been carried out in the Gaza Strip. They are not allowed to visit Al-Quds. You can imagine that Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank are not allowed to visit Al-Quds without getting Israeli-issued permits, and it's almost impossible for Palestinians to get, especially for Palestinian males under the age of 45. So they have witnessed nothing but living under occupation. They have no dreams but to fight the Israeli forces, to bring the Israeli occupation to an end in order to live normal life. This is what they want. They want to live a normal life, but this cannot be happened as long as the Israeli occupation continues and as long as the Israeli forces go on with their atrocities and aggression against the Palestinians.
Meanwhile, the UN General Assembly has asked the International Court of Justice to consider consequences for Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories. And that covers the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination as well as Israeli efforts to Judaize Al-Quds. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected the resolution and the United Nations outright.
It didn't take more than a day after the most controversial and right-wing cabinet took over in Israel, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. The UNGA acted swiftly and asked the ICJ to consider the consequences for Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories.
Israeli practices and settlement activities affecting the rights of the Palestinian people and other Arabs of the occupied territories, end of quote.
It appeared as though the timing was pre-planned, and that the resolution was a signal to the new administration. Lots of cheers from PA Ambassador to the UN on the matter, though.
This vote and request comes one day after the new Israeli government was formed, pledging to accelerate colonial and racist policies against the Palestinian people.
It came as no surprise that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had the complete opposite view, saying that Israel is not bound by the UN vote. But does this resolution and referral to the ICJ even make a difference where Israel is concerned, or Palestinians for that matter? Definitely not. The reasons speak for themselves. As far as the ICC is concerned, Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. This is while the International Criminal Court has determined that it does have jurisdiction over the territories occupied by Israel despite Israel's insistence to the contrary. So what is the point of all of this if it won't change the facts on the ground? Well, aside from Israel not being a member of the ICC, it disputes its jurisdiction on the basis that Palestine is not a sovereign state that is capable of being a party to the Rome Statute. The UNGA areas of focus have been issues that Israel has not heeded, nor has it even taken into account. Violation by Israel on the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, as well as altering the demographic composition of Al-Quds, is something that Israel has been actively doing. Not only that, coming right out of the gates, this administration has already said that it will go against the resolution. When it comes to the UN, Israel has had the most UN resolutions slapped against it, over 70 and counting. Israel has followed none. The Israeli ambassador, Gilad Erdan, has called the resolution moral stain on the UN. He said no international body can decide that the Jewish people are occupiers in their own homeland, adding any decision from a judicial body which receives its mandate from the morally bankrupt and politicized UN is completely illegitimate. The UNGA resolution also exposes the hypocrisy of the so-called normalization of some Persian Gulf Arab countries with Israel. The resolution had virtually unanimous support from the Islamic world, including Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel.
And it is not the first time that Israel has rejected the ICC or ICJ for that matter. A 2021 investigation was rejected by then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Again, the ICC was planning to investigate crimes committed in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip for possible war crimes.
The new Israeli administration is described as being the most religious and right-wing in Israel's history. So extreme, it has even put it at odds with Israelis inside of Israel. Additionally, it has rattled the cages of Israel's closest allies while escalating tensions with the Palestinians. This new coalition has explicitly called for illegal settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank to be its top priority, vowing to legalize dozens of illegally built outposts and to annex the occupied territory. The incoming Minister of National Security, Ben-Gvir, who will be responsible for the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Israeli police, and the Palestinians inside of Israel, has openly called for settlement expansion. Ben-Gvir also supports Jewish prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. Here's another point to consider. The United States, Britain, and Germany have opposed the UNGA resolution. The question that can be asked here is, if these countries voted against the resolution, doesn't that mean that they are in essence giving Israel the green light to go ahead with what the UNGA had proposed, like changing the demographics and the Islamic identity at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, or preventing the Palestinians' right of return, and other issues like settlements? The UK ambassador to the UN has already taken a defensive position when it comes to Israel.
We are deeply concerned at instability on the West Bank and call on all sides to work together to urgently de-escalate the situation. The UK will be voting no on the resolution. Israeli practices affecting human rights of the Palestinian people in the occupied Palestinian territories, including East Jerusalem, because we do not feel that a referral to the International Court of Justice is helpful in bringing the parties back to dialogue.
What appears to be certain is that the Palestinians may be facing an even bleaker future with this extreme coalition cabinet that has been formed. This can only mean that the crimes against the Palestinians may go into overdrive in this new year. And that is very hard to imagine, given that Israel has already violated Palestinians' right to such extremes that going beyond what has been done already is hard to imagine. It now remains to be seen how the world will react once this administration begins its work in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Turning elsewhere, Seoul and Washington are discussing potential joint exercises using U.S. nuclear assets to counter North Korea's growing nuclear and missile threats. That's according to the South Korean president. South Korean media has cited Yoon Suk-yeol as saying that the joint exercises would be aimed at a more effective implementation of the U.S. extended deterrence. That's in reference to the U.S.'s commitment to providing its nuclear forces to deter attacks on its allies, including South Korea. Yoon made the remarks a day after the North Korean leader ordered the development of new nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles to counter U.S.-led threats. Tensions between the two neighbors on the Korean Peninsula show no sign of abating. On Sunday, the North fired a short-range missile off its east coast that followed three ballistic missile launches the previous day. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Mountain climbing has always been my favorite hobby. You know, taking a trip to nature after a busy, stressful week helps me get refreshed. And if this nature traveling be accompanied by exciting adventures, will be more attractive. Sorry, sir. How can I get to Darband Cave?
Drive directly to Shah Mirzad. After 2 kilometers, you'll see the cave's sign.
Thank you. I have an appointment with a group of mountain climbers who are going to visit Darband Cave. They have taken a bus to the cave. However, I have driven my own car. I'm going to stay in Semnan province for a few days.
And that's our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Here it is. It's the cave's sign. Darband Cave is one of the largest limestone caves in Iran, located 2 kilometers north of Darband region in Mahdishahr city, Semnan province, northern Iran. This cave can be found on the southern slopes of Alborz mountain range and on the heights of Darband. This cave was inhabited by humans in the past. Darband Cave, with a length of nearly 114 meters, is located at an altitude of 2,000 meters above the sea. It is interesting to know that the height of the crater from the foot of the mountain is 300 meters and its widest part is 36 meters. Among the artifacts found in this cave, we can mention the broken parts of pottery, the oldest of which have been estimated to date back to the first millennium AD. This cave is known for its huge stalactites, which have a regular shape, in heights ranging from 4 to 14 meters. Getting close. I should find the touristic bus of the mountain climbers. Aha! Here it is. Hey!
You have to take safety precautions. Don't move individually. In order to reach the cave's entrance, you have to take an earth road. You'll hike a 350-meter road, which consists of 650 stairs that we should walk up. Any questions? Okay, then. We'll set off.
I was wondering that how hard it was for primitive human beings to live in a cave. In other words, the earliest world civilizations were so different from today's world. Conflicts and natural disasters forced primitive human beings to shelter in mountain heights, in caves, so that they could stay safe. Well, we are at the cave's opening. I'm so excited to go inside and see this historical cave. At the beginning, there is an oval hall with a length of nearly 114 meters. In some parts of the cave, the width is 36 meters. We move further. The difference between this cave and other caves is that it doesn't have twists and turns. However, this cave is unique historically. Look at the air. Stalactites are intertwined in a way as if an engineer has put them together. Great.
Okay, guys. Come closer, everyone. That is the longest column in the cave. What a sight.
So here we are. Oh, it's incredible. Its length is 15 meters. And as we hike further, more stalactites do appear, which end in a water pool. Here it is. However, it's not drinking water. It's full of minerals. And at the end of the cave, there is a part which is called Takht-e Bozorg. It's said that this place was used to be inhabited by primitive humans. Even imagining such a thing is really hard. Living in a cave? I don't know. I'm a little bit confused. Maybe those people had difficulty with living in our modern world. Well, it was an amazing experience. I'm outside the cave, and the only thing that completes my happiness at the moment is making a pot of Iranian tea on firing woods. By the way, Semnon has many spectacular sights to see, which I have plans to visit them all. Thank God. My beautiful Iran is home to the most stunning wonders of the world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Goodbye 2022 and hello to the year 2023. The verdict is out on whether you had a good year or not. In the case of countries that were on the receiving end of U.S. foreign policy, this was not a stellar year for the U.S. From the maximum pressure campaign against Iran, which included sanctions and riot support, i.e. regime change, to the war on Yemen, the U.S. has not achieved any of its desired results. We will look at whether the U.S. objectives are what's at fault here, including the miserable state of Afghanistan, and how the U.S. continues to loot Syrian oil while many of its allies are getting closer to Syria once again. Iran, Syria, Yemen, and Afghanistan, and U.S. foreign policy failures, that's what we'll be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. Our guests are Masoud Chaudhry from the Islamic Human Rights Commission joins us from London. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Masoud Chaudhry, first over to you. Rightly so, I'll begin with the Iran riots and the way that, I should say the U.S. Mainly, but it's really the U.S. and its spy agency, the CIA, along with other spy agencies, which include UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. That was a joint statement by the intel ministries of Iran that came out and accused all of them. But the CIA seemed to have been pivotal in the role that it played, and how they cooperated with each other in order to execute ultimately what they have in mind, which was a regime change policy. Do you think that has failed?
Absolutely. I think not only it has failed, but it was implemented because of the other failures, because of the failure of maximum pressure, because of the failure of trying to convince even nations to sort of become opponent of Iran. The reality is there is an imprint being given international community that everyone is against Iran. But the reality is that everyone is just United States, Canada, and the Western sort of European, plus Israel and Saudi Arabia. That's not everyone. The reality is the world much bigger. This impression which has been created, it's there to serve the hegemony of the United States. And I think we are seeing these sort of desperate now, vis-a-vis sort of trying to sort of destabilize Iran from internally. It's because everything else has failed. And I'll go even further and say United States of America and its hegemony is on the end of its time. We are seeing the beginning of the end of that power. And that is why actually its policies around the world are failure altogether. When you look at its policy with China, policy in South America, its policy with Russia, whichever policy that you're looking at, it actually failing because United States is failing. United States is losing its power, and it knows, and it is actually becoming more oppressive and more aggressive because of that fact.
Zafar Bangash, it's very telling the way that the U.S. has actually carried out its maximum pressure campaign. When you take a look back not too far long, ago, back in 2007, where there was a report that the U.S. was secretly funding what was called militant ethnic separatist groups in Iran. And this was in order to pile up pressure on the Islamic Republic to give up its nuclear program. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because we had Iran's leader not too long ago actually make a statement almost to that effect, where he said that the recent riots are part of the West's pressure campaign on Iran to compromise on its rights in the negotiations that were taking place in terms of Iran's civilian nuclear program. So we can see that this resembles what's happening now with what was happening back then. Bush Jr., $400 million was what he had allocated to covert activities against Iran. Even back then, it failed. So this maximum pressure campaign, which involves sanctions, by the way, which Iranians have suffered from it when it comes especially in the field of health, has failed, yet the U.S. has not learned its lesson. Why is that?
Well, basically because the U.S. is addicted to war, or should I say that the American rulers are addicted to war, because war for the American rulers is a racket. They earn a lot of money from it. If you look at the recent military budget that the Biden regime had sent to Congress, the regime asked for $813 billion, which is in fact the highest military budget in American history, and yet the Congress approved $858 billion in military budget for next year. So that means that the Congress is also in the pocket of the arms industry, the weapons manufacturers, and it is in the U.S.'s interest, or the oligarchs' interest, to continue to wage wars around the world, to continue campaigns of destabilization. And their target, the specific target, is the Islamic Republic of Iran, for the simple reason that the Islamic Republic of Iran has broken out of the stranglehold of the hegemonic world order that had been created after the Second World War. So Iran's example in terms of pursuing an independent foreign policy, both foreign policy as well as internal policy, is seen by the United States oligarchs as a threat to their hegemony. And so they continue to attempt different ways, even though, as you mentioned, all of their tactics so far over the last 44 years have failed as far as Iran is concerned, but they don't give up. They keep on trying one way or the other. It is because they are addicted to imposing their hegemony on others. But regrettably for the U.S., the world is changing rapidly. It is no longer a unipolar world. It has become a multipolar world in which Iran plays a pivotal role. And so in that sense, Iran continues to be a major target of the United States despite its successive failures. And now we see the U.S. is even taking on Russia and China. Again, I think it is going to face massive failures over there as well, because there are a number of issues that are coming to the fore, a number of policies that are being implemented that would ultimately undermine American blackmailing tactics and these aggressive tactics. Okay. That would herald the end of America as an empire.
When our guest there talks about the defense budget, I should say, Master Sajjara, shouldn't it appropriately be called a war budget? Because we're looking at how that has played out in West Asia. And the next country we'd like to focus on and ask you about is Yemen. I mean, we know the humanitarian situation there. We know the fact that Joe Biden came out during his presidential campaign saying, I'm going to make sure that this war stops. But he didn't do that. He even backtracked on that pledge. One of the sales was $650 million to Saudi Arabia. Why did he backtrack on that pledge that he so touted during his presidential campaign, along with other Democratic lawmakers?
Well, I will go even further. I would not even just call it war budget. I would say colonial budget. They are war would be described as defensive. It's actually the offensive, abusive war, which is unleashed on Yemen, one of the poorest nations, and it has created the greatest catastrophe of time. And you know, see the same thing everywhere else. You know, look at the sort of the handiwork of United States and its allies, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, you know, South America, and you know, everywhere they have shown their ugly head. They have brought nothing except this disability. They have not brought any democracy anywhere. As a matter of fact, the only democracy...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Master Shajar, we have a bad connection with you. Your words are getting repeated. I do apologize. Let's try to fix that. And let me turn to Zafar Bangash. Zafar Bangash, so we have this relationship between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince, which is on the rocks, should I say. But it's not something that is behind closed doors. We have seen the very cool reception that the Saudi Crown Prince gave Joe Biden. Quite the opposite to what it did with Chinese President Xi Jinping. But going back to Yemen, which is suffering one of the worst, if not the worst, humanitarian situation, and given the fact that this relationship has cooled down, why doesn't the U.S. President take advantage of that and make good on his pledge and stop the support that it gives Saudi Arabia when it comes to the war in Yemen?
Well, we need to understand why the United States is actually supporting the war on Yemen. Back in 2001, immediately after 9/11, one of the American generals, General Wesley Clark, he said in an interview that he had gone to the Pentagon about a week or 10 days after the events of 9/11. And there, one of the generals told him that the United States has decided to overthrow the governments in seven countries. And among the list of those countries, of course, in addition to Iraq, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, Sudan, Syria, etc., Yemen was also included in that. And the reason why the Americans are backing the Saudi war in Yemen is because the Americans want to control the flow of oil through the Red Sea, particularly, you know, Bab al-Mandab, which is crucial to the flow of oil from there, just like the American military or naval armada prowls in the Persian Gulf. So they also want to control the flow of oil through the Red Sea. And the fact that in Yemen, the Ansarullah fighters have basically taken control of much of the northern part of Yemen, that obviously is seen as a threat to U.S. hegemony. So on the one hand, while Biden has a personal grudge against Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince as well as Saudi prime minister, yet as far as U.S. policy in Yemen is concerned, it continues with that aggressive tone because of its desire sure. to control the flow of oil through that region. And we see that, you know, the Americans, the British, the French, they're all supporting the Saudis with massive amounts of armaments. So as long as they sell their weapons to the Saudis, mm-hmm. even if there is a personal tiff between Mohammed bin Salman and Biden, that is not allowed to come in the way. So the Yemeni policy has to be seen in that broader context rather than this narrow context of Biden's dislike of Mohammed bin Salman.
I'd like to figure out the U.S. policy, really, when it comes to countries in the West Asia region, Masoud Shajar. And I'm going to start out with a quote before I ask you the question and see if you can maybe guess as to which country this is. When you have Bob Crowley, the retired Army colonel, who served as the counterinsurgency advisor at the U.S. military headquarters in this country, who said the strategy became self-validating. Every data point was altered to present the best possible picture. Another, Donald Rumsfeld, I'm sure you're familiar with him, who's passed away, who was the U.S. Defense Secretary, who said, I have no visibility into who the bad guys are. The country, Afghanistan. You would think that the U.S. would, at a minimum, know what's going on there. But this particular investigative report, which revealed some real truths, showed the not even the elementary aspects of war was known to the highest war and military personnel that were involved in it.
Yes, absolutely. I think that sort of re-strengthened the reality that, you know, some people think that the United States policies in Middle East and South America and elsewhere is for national interest. But the reality is that it's not for the national interest as we know it, the interests of all the Americans. It's actually for the interest of a small section of powerful lobbyists and influencers, like the arms industry, like the Zionist lobby, and so forth and so on. And then when you look at it from that perspective, then you really understand why we are getting what we are getting. Why is it that they go to war when it's not really the interest of anyone? It's not the interest of ordinary people in the United States. It's not the interest of people in locality. They destroy and they are deliberately creating havoc. And, you know, under the name of trying to bring democracy. And this policy, it's really so embedded into U.S. If you remember just a couple of months ago, even the progressives like Sanders were coming out and saying, hell with Saudi Arabia, they're not bringing the price down, we should go for them. You know, it really, it seems that they are so aggressive against everyone. What is defined as sort of American interest is really nothing more than selling as much arms, looking after that 1%, not the whole 90, not the rest of the 99% of people in the United States. And this is the corruption in the highest level, which is part and parcel of the hegemony of United States. And indeed, it's because of this that we are seeing the beginning of the end of the empire. And because, you know, even ordinary people in the United States are awakening to this.
Sure. Well, let's move on to Syria, Zafar Bangash, and take a look at the U.S. policy on Syria. Well, there was a U.S. policy on Syria, I think, when they started getting engaged in counter, offensives against the democratically elected president of that country, Bashar al-Assad, which many turned out to say that that became an obsession to remove him from power. But what is the U.S. policy on Syria now? I mean, I'm safe to assume or conclude that their U.S. policy failed. And this involved a number of their allies that poured a lot of money and arms into this. So what is the U.S. policy on Syria now? What is it doing in Syria?
Well, basically, the U.S. Policy on Syria is not only a total failure, but they're trying to cover up their failure by stealing Syrian oil and Syrian grain. Basically, the U.S. Got involved in Syria as part of that overall policy that was outlined back in 2001, immediately after 9/11, that they wanted to bring down the government of Syria. And the ultimate objective, of course, was that once the government of Syria is overthrown, then that would open the way for the U.S. to militarily attack Iran and overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. But of course, because of the help that Iran and Hezbollah and later on Russia extended to Syria, that the Syrian government was not overthrown. The Syrian government held its ground, and today even America's allies have realized that they cannot overthrow the government in Syria, that they have to deal with Bashar al-Assad, that he is the legitimately elected president of Syria, and that they have to deal with it. And so, in that sense, America's policy is a total failure. And this is where I think it is important to keep in mind that when there is a sound policy to confront American hegemony, that it can be defeated, it can be brought to its knees. And today, obviously, in Syria, we find that the United States policy has completely failed. As it failed in Iraq, as it failed in Afghanistan, it was a total disaster in Afghanistan. The U.S., after 20 years, had to put its tail between its legs and flee the country, and leaving it devastated. And yet, through those ragtag bands of the Taliban, the Americans were defeated. So we see that at every level, American policies have failed in the West Asia and Middle Eastern region. But as I mentioned earlier on, because of the American oligarchs' obsession with wars, they unfortunately do not give up their mischief making until they are so soundly defeated that the American economy is brought to its knees, and then they will actually get back into their own territory and stop interfering and disrupting the lives of other people.
Master Sajjar, I guess Zafar Bangash says that here he made a point to highlight that he said, you see, when countries unite, they can actually realize their mistake, and then at this point, the rapprochement that's happening between Syria and some of the countries that were against President Bashar al-Assad. For example, Turkey potentially now working on that, and then we had the UAE that embraced the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But isn't it sad that it has to come down to that when you involve more than 500,000 people that have been killed? I mean, every one of the scenarios of these countries that we talked about involves a lot of suffering, involves a humanitarian catastrophe. Not only these countries, we don't have time to talk about Iraq. And, of course, we're looking, my question to you, at the future. The U.S. is still aggressively pursuing a war on a war path when it comes to, for example, Russia and China. My question is, what can be done to prevent that from happening? Or is that just the state of affairs when you have what some have called a bully on the world stage that wants to get his way through, especially when they have an $850 billion war budget?
Absolutely. And it's not just the war budget. It's actually the propaganda machine, the Western sort of media, and the way that they're silencing everyone else, shrinking spaces for the truth to be spoken to the power. And when you put all these things together, we are getting what we are getting now. But I think it's very important, as you highlighted, that there is a remedy to stand up against aggression, to resist against it, to come together like what happened in Syria. But even on sort of the situation in Afghanistan showed that even the Taliban resisting over all that period, they were eventually victorious, and the United States had to put his tail between his leg and run away. What is very important for us to sort of highlight this internationally? Look, one could argue that it was a bad policy what happened in Afghanistan, and it was a misguided policy. They underestimated, etc. Then it happens in Iraq, you know, and all of us sort of campaign against that war, saying it's going to bring nothing except misery, death, and destruction. And we were proven right. And then we saw it happening in Libya and in Syria. For God's sake, how many more we have to see this sort of policy of destruction to benefit the Zionist entity, to benefit the war industry and the manufacturing of weapons, to benefit that 1% while everybody else suffers. We need to speak out much more clearer on this. And the danger for the United States is for people to wake up. And this is why they're silencing, be it RT or be it press TV or be it even social media. There is an attempt to demonize anyone who's speaking the truth to power. And I think we need to recognize that the only way forward is for us to actually speak louder and clearer and make sure that people in Europe and elsewhere understand the real policy of death and destruction.
Thank you so much for that. Master Sajjar, the Islamic Human Rights Commission, and Zafar Bangash, thank you, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRI, the English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
You're welcome. For today's discussion, we want to talk about the ways in order to be closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and whether shedding tears in contrast to being happy is a more, or it's better to say, is the closest way to get close to Allah or to reach proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We know that according to some Islamic beliefs, doing supplication, shedding tears, being in, we can say, having a kind of melancholic and sad feelings, gets you somehow more closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Is it at all approved or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If you want to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, sometimes it is necessary to make people happy, not always crying or weeping.
Yes.
You know that we have numerous narrations of Ahlul Bayt, the pure progeny of Noble Prophet Muhammad, that it is, kind of obligatory upon you, very recommended actually.
Yes.
Upon you to make people happy, especially the faithful people,
yes.
Mu'mineen, and which we call it Idkhalu Surur, to make them happy.
Yes.
You know, numerous reward has been counted upon those people who make people happy, financially speaking, I don't know, in different ways.
Spiritually speaking.
Spiritually speaking, yes. In different ways, of course, in a legal way.
Yes.
And decent way to make people happy, to make them, you know, laugh and to be happy, and to, you know, different methods you can imagine.
Yes.
So it is not always weeping and crying. We have different ways for, you know, getting closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So and you mean through this happiness and smiling, and as you said, adkhal surur, giving a kind of happiness and pleasure to the people, you can make them closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
You can make yourself closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right. I want to say that not always weeping and crying is a inclusive way for getting closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Rather, we have different methods and different ways. What is important here is obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is ta'atullah.
Yes.
We have different narrations and different verses of Noble Quran which invite us to be obedient to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to obey Him, to be real servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, this obedience, I need to explain that it doesn't mean blind obedience. Rather, the result and the consequence of these obedience comes to the human being himself.
Yes.
For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala encourages us to be, to have volunteer action for other fellow human beings.
Yes.
To provide some services for poor people, for destitute.
To give charity and sadaqah.
Give charity.
Yes.
I want to say that this obedience, we can say all results of that come to the human being himself herself.
Okay.
So what is important here is, in different verses of Noble Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about to be real servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, it has a lot of category if you want to be a real servant, an obedient servant to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Sometimes by laughing, sometimes by making people happy, and so on and so forth.
Sometimes the Muslim communities, especially the Shiite communities, we can say, are accused that you only want to get people closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala through shedding tears, through lamentation, through marthias, through, we can say, especially on the martyrdom anniversaries and condolences, okay? So all in all, we can say the majority of your focus is on making them as sad as, and